This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Adam Driver, is best known for his role on the HBO series Girls as Hannah's on-again, off-again boyfriend, Adam. Driver is one of the stars of the new film comedy, While We're Young, which was written and directed by Noah Baumbach. It's about the conflicts between youth and middle age. Driver plays Jamie, a young, hip guy who wants to make documentary films. He shows up in the classroom of a middle-aged documentary filmmaker, played by Ben Stiller. Stiller's character, Josh, has made one well-received film, but has been working on his next film for 10 years and can't figure out how to complete it. As the young Jamie tries to ingratiate himself to Josh and enlist Josh's help in the film world, Jamie and his wife, played by Amanda Seyfried, manage to start hanging out with Josh and his wife, Cornelia, played by Naomi Watts. Terry spoke with Driver last Thursday and began with this scene from the film, in which the two couples are finishing dinner at a restaurant. Naomi Watts' character, Cornelia, speaks first.
What do you do, Darby?
Darby makes ice cream.
Yeah, I make ice cream.
I brought some of it to the Whole Foods near us. They're pumped.
It's Jamie's idea to sell it. I just do it because I like it.
And you guys are married. That's so nice and old-fashioned.
Yeah, we said our vows in an empty water tower in Harlem.
There was a mariachi band and a slip and slide.
Wow. Oh. It was beautiful. Some rituals
Jamie
exist for
a big
reason,
wedding.
You know?
We did it at City Hall.
Isaac and Benny are walking the tracks.
Oh, have you done this? We walked through the subway tunnels of the D line last week.
No, we haven't.
They're at a bar on Essex. Do you want to come?
Oh, do we?
It's already past our bedtime.
Yeah, we're usually in bed by 11. Let me get it.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
No, yeah, I'll get it.
Adam Driver, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have
you
on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I should say, I just listened back to that clip, but you didn't. You declined to hear it. You took off your headphones. Why don't you want to hear the clip of your film or your own work?
Because I don't want to hear the bad acting that probably was happening during that clip.
Does it throw you off to hear yourself?
Yeah, no, I've watched myself or listened to myself before, then always hate it and then wish I could change it, but you can't. And I think I have like a tendency to try to make things better or drive myself and the other people around me crazy with the things I wanted to change or I wish I could change.
So is there like a safety zone where after a period of time, it's safe for you to go back and watch? Like, can you watch the first season of Girls or your scene in Lincoln?
No, never seen them. No, yeah.
Never.
No, I like doing on it. And then when we're working on it in the moment, and then it's done and we do it, and then I try to surrender as much control as possible. It's so collaborative to me that you can act in a room, but if no one's there to light it right or hair and makeup and the director, like it's so what you're creating right then in the moment. I don't think of it as like a done set thing that people watch and may have their opinions about. I let it be what it is and then try to move on in my mind as soon as possible.
So you're not aware of how awful you really were in While We're Young. Just kidding.
No, I am aware of that. That's the problem. Then I just look for affirmation that I was right.
Well, you were good. You were very good. Oh. So if you're just joining us, my guest is Adam Driver, who plays Adam on Girls, and now he co-stars in the new movie While We're Young. How did you get the part on Girls?
I auditioned.
Was it a big, like a large number of people auditioning?
I don't know. I was the first person to audition, actually. And
were you asked to audition?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was doing a play at the time and thought TV was evil and like not where I wanted to be or do. I wanted to do theater. And my agent convinced me to go in because I was having a real high horse moment. And that's when I met Lena, and that was kind of it. And they called me in for a second audition, I think, a couple days later, and that was all.
Did you have any experiences in your 20s resembling the experiences of the characters on Girls?
I didn't, no. I was in the military at the beginning of my 20s. And then when I left the military, went right into an acting conservatory, which is, again, not like a really regular kind of college. It's really strange. I mean, you're locked up with 18-year-old, 18 to 19 to 20, and sometimes a couple of students who are older, acting conservatory. Then you were just with 18 or 19-year-old, also strangers, you know, in the Marine Corps. So they couldn't have been more opposite.
I'd like to play a scene from Girls. I know you won't want to hear it.
I'm taking the phones off.
do you take your headphones off, and the rest of us will listen to this scene. But you might just want to hear me describe the scene so that you know what we've all heard.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Okay, so this is from not the season that just ended, but the season before that. And it's been, you know, it's been great to watch your character, like, you know, grow and mature and become an actor. And this is on your character's big opening night at the theater. But he's really unnerved by Hannah. He's temporarily moved out of their apartment so he could be in his own headspace while he's rehearsing and preparing for this show. But on opening night, Hannah goes backstage just before the show's about to start to tell you some big news. She's been admitted to the Iowa Writers Workshop, and she's going to accept. That would mean her moving out of New York, which has big implications for your relationship with her, but it's really like the wrong time for you to be focusing on that, and it's so typical of Hannah to make your opening night about her. So after the performance, Hannah and her friend Elijah, played by Andrew Rannells, are waiting for you at the stage door, and Elijah speaks first. Now, okay. Adam, take off your headphones.
All right. Well.
Hey!
Congratulations!
Awesome job!
Hi, my love!
So good!
You were amazing!
No, I wasn't. I was terrible.
Are you kidding me? Adam, I had full body chills.
Yes, she's not joking. She had chills.
So you guys, why'd you tell me that thing about Iowa right before I went on stage? Blew it.
Okay, do you live in, like, a parallel universe? There's no way that was blowing it. Everybody was talking about how much they loved
it. I don't care what everyone says. I know if I'm good or not. This is exactly what I thought would happen. This is exactly why they want to see you.
I'm going to go ahead, and I will meet you guys at the party, all right?
Elijah loved the play.
Oh, good.
I told you that thing about grad school because I felt that it was really good news for us as a couple.
So now you're leaving me?
Leaving you? Adam, you're the one who moved out of our apartment.
I moved a few blocks away for a few weeks.
I know that this is complicated, but I also know that we can work it out.
Well, I'm sick of trying to work it out. Can't one thing ever be easy with you?
Congratulations on a beautiful opening night.
Adam Driver, are you back with us?
I am.
I'd love to hear your take on your character Adam's relationship with Hannah. You've done a fair number of sex scenes with Lena Dunham on Girls. What did you want to know beforehand, before actually shooting those scenes? I assume those were your first, that you were like an on-screen virgin before that?
I was, yeah, very much so, especially compared to what we did. I think
right.
I felt pretty good with it, not in a weird, like, what's the word when people like to get naked?
Exhibitionist?
Yeah, not in a weird exhibitionist way, but more for the story. It seemed to, what she was really going after, it didn't seem...
exploitive?
Yeah, thank you. Jesus.
just keep going.
it was very much in line with those characters. It wasn't just, you know, graphic sex for the sake of it or just for the sake of being controversial. There was always so much conversation went around those scenes.
Yeah, they were real talkers, like, in that first season.
Yeah, it gets pretty graphic. But what exactly is the story that we're trying to tell? What are we trying to say with it? And then... what do we kind of want to leave open and not have so defined?
So your background is, as you said, very different from the characters on Girls. You grew up in Indiana. You enlisted in the Marines soon after 9/11. Was that the year after you graduated high school?
Yeah, I graduated the summer. Then by January or February 1st, I was gone.
So what impact did 9/11 have on you that led you to... enlist?
Well, probably like a lot of people in the country, I felt a sense of patriotism and wanted retribution and wanted to do something. And that coupled with the fact that I wasn't doing anything, I was working a bunch of odd jobs, selling vacuum cleaners and kind of just making it, living in the back of my parents' house, paying rent, not doing anything, and wanted to do something, wanted to, test my manhood and serve my country and just get even. And
get away from home.
And get away from home and everything that I didn't like about it, and that in retrospect was actually pretty great. And, all those things kind of going on at the same time, it seemed like a good idea. All my friends actually at the same time, too. I remember having long into the night conversations about what we were going to do, and I was the only one who actually joined.
So you enlisted in the Marines a few months after 9/11. Or about a year after 9/11, after you graduated high school. And before your platoon was actually deployed, you broke your sternum in a mountain bike accident. Mm-hmm. So what was it like for you to have to leave for medical reasons before actually doing the work you'd enlisted to do?
It was pretty devastating. It took me a long time to get over it. I joined all these really... what I thought patriotic reasons and things I want to do. But all that kind of stuff goes away once you start getting into your unit and you start meeting the people that you're going to be serving with. And then it really, that kind of outside world or patriotism or even Democrat, Republican, it all kind of goes out the window, for me at least, I guess. And it's really about the people, this small, intimate, group of people that you are lucky enough to get to serve with. And it's about them. They're not going because you did something to yourself and, hurt yourself. Was pretty embarrassing and terrible. And I tried to go. I kept, loading up on drugs and trying to run. And they put me back in my unit, and it was fine. And then we did this hack. It was two clicks with a 90-pound pack, and my chest started to separate. So I had to go back on limited duty and, be on the board for medical separation. So I kind of screwed myself in the long run because I wanted to go so much. You're training to do this job for 2 years with these people. The idea of not going, someone else going in your place or not being there is not really an easy thing to sit with. Out and going to acting school. So it's meeting up with those guys later and they're like, what have you been doing? I don't know. I've been wearing pajamas and pretending to give birth to myself in an acting class, trying to face up to that is pretty devastating.
you said it was embarrassing to have to leave the Marines for medical reasons because you'd hurt yourself. Would it have not been embarrassing if you were injured in the line of duty as opposed to in a mountain biking accident?
Yeah, I think, here I was PTing with another friend of mine. I didn't know anything about mountain biking. But, of course, in your mindset at the time is like, well, then let's go to the highest mountain we can find and find the steepest drop-off, and then that's what we're going to do. That's going to be our exercise with these, stupid bikes. And when we did that, and then, they hit a ditch and the handlebars went in my chest and broke my sternum. And then you got to walk down the rest of the mountain, because it's not like I ate it, kind of midway. Then you kind of find a path and hobble down and get in a car and, drive to the hospital.
Did your platoon end up going to Iraq?
They did, yeah.
Were any of the men who you served with killed after they deployed to Iraq?
No. No, everyone made it back.
Right. Are you still in touch with any of them?
I am still in touch with them. They find what I do now very funny.
You've said in the past that the experience of being in the Marines made you determined to take acting seriously once you left the Marines. There was an incident with white phosphorus. Would you describe what happened and also tell us what white phosphorus is?
Yeah, white phosphorus is a chemical that's basically if you put a pop can of white phosphorus on top of a car, it'll just burn right through the car. It's a highly acidic chemical. And you can make it explode, once it hits the ground, once it goes into the ground and explodes, or above the ground, basically. And the FO, the forward observer, the guy who's alone, called in the wrong coordinates. And so artillery fired on us as opposed to what they were supposed to be firing, miles away from us.
This was an exercise? This was like a war game?
This is an exercise, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is the first time that anything like this happened, where you're like, oh, wow, we're not immortal. And we just hear this big boom. We look up and all this white phosphorus is coming down on us. And if it wasn't windy, you know, that coupled with the fact that we're, you know, running like a bunch of kids away from, you know, this white phosphorus raining down in front of our guns, that, we, you know, we all would have been dead. So I'm like, oh, okay, I'm the two things I want to do before I die is smoke and be an actor. Smoke cigarettes and be an actor. I don't know why those are the two things that I wanted to do, but those are the two things that I'm like, oh, I should do those things before I die.
Okay, so the determination to act after a near-death experience, I get that completely. The desire to smoke, after you're like, you've run for your life, it's like, what do I really want to do? Put smoke in my lungs because I've just run from white phosphorus. That makes no sense to me at all.
Yeah, the theme in my stories, I guess, is that they don't make much sense. They don't really add up to they're all very impulsive.
Were you already a smoker?
No.
People don't have the ambition to start smoking, though. It's like, yes, I've had a near, my dream is going to come true. I'm going to light up a cigarette. I don't get it at all.
Yeah, but if you're teetering with something and you're like, I wonder what that's like, then you're like, oh, I should find out what that's like. You know?
Oh,
like,
I see. Okay.
People seem to like that thing that that a lot of people do.
Did you?
So I did. Yeah. I did for a long time. But then, you know, you go down the whole rabbit hole of dipping and all that stuff. Then I kind of recently stopped because it's not good. You can't run and smoke.
Yeah, and you need your breath on stage too, don't you?
You need your breath to talk and
breathe.
You'll
be that, yeah.
You need your breath to breathe. I just said that.
So when you got to Juilliard, did being a vet affect how people saw you, especially people who opposed the war in Iraq? Did they have certain preconceptions of you, make assumptions about you?
Yeah, and me about them too. Like I feel like for me, I'm like, oh no, I'm really going to take this seriously. I'm going to like absorb all the training. I'll stay here I was really prepared to do anything because I felt I knew how precious life is and how time is so important. And then there are ideas of like, you know, oh, you're a Marine, so you're obviously going to hit somebody at some point and like, you know, I don't know, drag my knuckles around or something. I'm not sure what it was. I could feel their apprehension and being scared. And I guess I was apprehensive and scared too in a different way. Just to readjust, I had really strong judgments about civilians and thought of them as nasty, you know, civilians and who are just like not, who are wasting time and not disciplined. And it took me a while to kind of get over that. You know, it's a weird thing to turn off when suddenly you're getting into this crazy civilian world where people are wearing their hats indoors and like their clothes untucked and kind of like, you know, wander in a room like looking nasty and like cleaning crud out of their eyes. Like I was ready to act and throw all my effort into it.
So what kind of roles did you get when you were at Juilliard?
A lot of angry. No, I don't know.
Julia. Were you kidding about a lot of angry part? Were you getting a lot of
angry
roles?
No. I mean, that's something I think I wanted to do, but I think they pushed me away from that as much as possible.
Because you were feeling angry?
Yeah. Well, plus you're in your 20s, so I feel like you're kind of angry about everything.
Let's talk about growing up. You grew up in, pronounce it for me?
Mishawaka.
In Indiana. Is that a small town or a suburb?
Yeah, it's 40,000 people.
Mm-hmm. And when did you first get interested in acting? Because you were interested in acting before you even enlisted.
I was, yeah. I did plays in high school. But there wasn't a lot of, like, it didn't seem like something like a reasonable thing I could do in Mishawaka, Indiana. Also got grounded a lot, so I couldn't do plays. But
grounded by school or by your parents?
My parents, yeah. I didn't get good grades and really wasn't interested in school. But was interested in doing plays and did Arsenic and Old Lace, and that was really fun. But then, the idea of going to New York or – I don't know why I didn't think about – actually, I did think about California. At one point, I tried to move to California to be an actor because I heard all those stories of people like moving to California with $5, you know, and then being an actor. This is right when I graduated. And my car broke down. I had a 1990 Lincoln Town Car outside of Amarillo, Texas, and I had to walk 10 miles to Amarillo and then spend all my money on getting my car fixed. I had everything in my car. Like a refrigerator and all my possessions, basically. And I made a really big production about saying goodbye, too. That's what I remember. That was really embarrassing. Like, goodbye, friends. You know, like, I'll see you when I see you. You know, I'll see you on the big screen. And, you know, kind of like had the conversation with my girlfriend at the time, like, this is going to be hard, you know, like, but we'll figure out a way to to survive. And then by the time I got, even make it to L.A., just made it to Santa Monica to meet like a professor who taught film or something like that. Was my connection, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I was staying in a youth hostel and I had no money. Like, I just had no more money, and calling home to ask for money wasn't an option. So I took the final $200 that I had to pay for gas and drove all the way back. I drove right back to Indiana. I think I was probably gone for maybe total a week.
So did you think, well, I blew it. I'll never have that chance again. Give up on the whole acting idea?
Yeah. Yeah, that was...
And is that when you joined the Marines?
A couple months after that, yeah. Well, obviously, this is before... September 11th, and
I
remember they sent me a brochure in the mail, the Marine Corps, and I remember having an argument, you know, because I wasn't doing anything, and that was an option that was presented to me by my parents. You should, you know, think about it. No way. And then months later, then September 11th happened, and then suddenly, it was, you know, things changed.
So this is another example of why your life seemed to be going nowhere at the time you joined the Marines.
Yeah, that's a good example. My life is going
one
nowhere.
One of the best.
Yeah, selling vacuum cleaners to people at my parents' church, and then still not buying it. I'm like, they go to my parents' church, so this is totally going to be an in.
Adam Driver, thank you for talking with us. It's been great.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Driver spoke with Terry last Thursday. Driver is one of the stars of the new film comedy While We're Young and co-stars on the HBO series Girls. Kendrick Lamar made a big impact with his 2012 major label debut, Good Kid, Mad City, and won 2 Grammys recently for the single I. Lamar's new album, To Pimp a Butterfly, is eclectic, influenced by jazz as much as funk or pop. His subjects touch on current events, such as the deaths of young black men, but he's also one of the few young rappers who is honest about personal struggles with depression and doubt. Ken Tucker has this review.
All's my life I has to fight. All's my life I hard times like yeah, bad trips like yeah, Nazareth. All's got us, then we gon' be alright.
Still in his 20s, Kendrick Lamar has attracted a large audience for his intricate wordplay and the diverse styles he strives for in a variety of songs. At this early point in his career, Lamar is intriguingly impossible to identify with a signature sound. The song that began this review, All Right, has a stark, airless production style. Contrast this with the dense, funky style of this song, King Kunta.
I can dig rapping. But a rapper with a ghost rider. What capping?
Oh no.
I swore I wouldn't tell. But most of y'all share bars like you got the bottle bunk in a 2-man sale. Something's in the water.
Something's in the water.
And if I got a brown nose for some gold, then I'd rather be a bum than a motherfucker.
Oh yeah.
Where you and I was walking. Now I run the game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta. Everybody wanna cut the legs off.
King Kunta.
Man taking no losses.
Oh yeah.
Where you and I was walking. Now I run the game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta. Everybody wanna cut the legs off.
King,
when you got the yams.
Lamar raps and sings most frequently in a pleasantly hoarse voice that works as the sound of earnest urgency. King Kunta takes its organizing image from one of the central figures of Alex Haley's book and TV movie Roots, the 18th century slave Kunta Kinte. The music surrounding that story draws equally from 1970s and 80s funk as perfected by James Brown, George Clinton, and Michael Jackson. For a different, distinctive example of Lamar's sonic range, listen to a bit of I, his Grammy-winning single.
Just to give you some game. A little more. I done been through a whole lot. Tried tribulation, but I know God. The devil wanna put me in a bow tie. Pray that the holy water don't go dry. Yeah, yeah. As I look around me, who wanna down me? But enemy gon' never drown me. In front of a dirty double mirror, they found me. And I love myself. Huh, I want you looking at me. Tell me what you see.
I love myself.
I put a bullet in the back of the back of the head of the police.
I love myself.
Illuminated by the hand of God. Boy, don't seem shy.
I love myself.
One day at a time. They wanna say it's a war outside. Bomb in the street, gun in the hood, mob of police. Black on the corner with a line full of fiend and a bottle full of lean and a motto on a scheme. These days of frustration keep come to the front. Yeah, I duck these cold faces. Post up, feed, fight, hope for basis. Dreams are reality's peace. Blow steam in the face of the beast. Sky can fall down, we can cry down. Look at me, I smile, I love my.
Using a sample from the Isley Brothers to propel the rhythm, Kendrick Lamar offers a mostly upbeat vision of life that nevertheless makes room to acknowledge that he's suffered from depression and doubt. Those more bleak subjects come to the fore in what might be considered the answer song to I, a harrowing, contrasting composition called You.
I place blame on you still, place shame on you still. Feel like you ain't, feel like you don't feel confidence in yourself. Breaking no marble floors, watching anonymous strangers telling me that I'm yours. But you ain't no confessional tolerance, nothing special. What can I blame you for? God can name several. Situation I start with your little sister baking. A baby aside, just a teenager, where your patience? What was your antennas? What was the influence you speak of? You preached in front of 100,000 but never reached her. I can tell you, can fail you, you ain't no leader. I never liked you, forever despised. I don't need you, the world don't need you. Don't let them deceive you. Numbers lie too, your pride too. That's what dedication. Thought money would change you, made you more complacent. I hate you, I hope you embrace it. I swear loving you is complicated. Loving you is complicated. Loving you is complicated.
Kendrick Lamar mixes the personal with the political in thoughtful ways. At the end of the song All Right, in a spoken word coda, Lamar speaks of being, quote, full of resentment, a resentment that turned into a deep depression, found myself screaming in the hotel room, I didn't want to self-destruct. He talks over the course of the entire album about growing up amidst gang violence in Compton, California, and makes connections to Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, the Black Panthers. He also discusses a different kind of struggle, the anxiety a young person feels growing up poor and fearful of violence, as well as the pressure that the success of becoming a pop star can yield.
I'm the biggest hypocrite in 2015. Once I finish this, witnesses will convey just what I mean. Been feeling this way since I was 16. Came to my senses. You never liked this anyway. Your friendship, I meant it. I'm African American. I'm African. I'm black as the moon. Heritage of a small village. Part of my residence. Came from the bottom of mankind. My hair is nappy. My is big, my nose is round and wide. You hate me, don't you? You hate my people. Your plan is to terminate my culture. Evil, I want you to recognize that I'm a proud monkey. You vandalize my perception, but can't take down from it. And this is more than confession. I mean, I might press the button just so you know my discretion. I'm guarding my feelings. I know that you feel it. You sabotage my community, making a killing. You made me a killer. Emancipation of a real.
To Pimp a Butterfly is an album to spend time with, to revel in its imaginatively combined array of influences. Kendrick Lamar works here with a number of notable musicians, including the jazz pianist Robert Glasper, and producers, most crucially, Thundercat. Lamar conveys the pleasures and difficulties of his life and many other lives, creating in the process a rich world of roiling emotions and sharp-witted ideas.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Kendrick Lamar's latest album, To Pimp a Butterfly. When our next guest, Philip Glass, started performing his own music, which was based on repetition and change, a lot of people didn't know what to make of it. Some people thought it sounded like the needle of a record was stuck in a groove, repeated over and over again. Some people thought it was simplistic. Some thought it was a joke. But those who loved it realized something new was happening. A new musical language he was developing in parallel with composers like Steve Reich and Lamont Young. It was described as minimalist, even though Glass would tell you it was anything but. Although Glass studied at the Peabody Conservatory of Music as a child, is a Juilliard graduate, and studied in Paris with renowned classical music teacher Nadia Boulanger, his music was initially shunned by the classical music world. but it was embraced in the worlds of avant-garde art and theater and experimental music. He's now considered one of the most important composers of his generation, and his work has become so accepted it's been used in film scores and even TV commercials. Glass has written a new memoir called Words Without Music. Terry spoke with Glass last Monday and began with an excerpt from his 1976 opera, Einstein on the Beach.
Philip Glass, welcome to Fresh Air. When you first started playing your music, people who didn't get it were sometimes angry, and I'd like to begin by asking you to tell the story of the guy who stormed the stage and sat down at your piano.
That was quite a while ago. He didn't actually sit down on the piano. He didn't get that far. He came up and began banging on the piano. This was in Amsterdam, and I played a piece of Steve Reich's and a piece called Two Pages, and I guess it could drive you crazy a little bit. I only had five notes in it, but I played it in those five notes in a lot of different ways, and I thought it was interesting. And this was about 1971, and the idea of music that was so, let's say, consciously or steadfastly repetitive was not so common then. And someone jumped on the stage and began banging on the piano, and without thinking about it, I stood up and I punched him on the jaw or something, and just like in the comic books, and he fell off the stage. Afterwards, Terry, the fellow was there, and he said, "Now we have the discussion." I said, "No, we had the discussion. Thank you," and that was it.
What do you think it was about your music that really upset some people?
I think he thought that I was making fun of him. Now this is an idea that people have, that artists are... When Pollock first began doing his drip paintings, people thought he was making fun of them, or they said, "Oh, my kid sister couldn't do the same kind of painting," or they thought that was kind of the idea of épicier les bourgeois, to
shock the bourgeoisie, to shock the middle class.
Yeah, that's right. But I think that's one thing. When people got really angry, I think they thought it was a personal affront. That somehow I was questioning their ability to hear music or discern music or whatever. It's also the emperor's clothes gimmick, that this was really the emperor's clothes. There was no real music there, and he was going to show me up by jumping on the stage and banging on the piano. But, it never really made much sense to me. But that wasn't so bad as when people threw things at you. Now, that could be... Now, if they threw apples and oranges, that wasn't so great. If they threw an egg, it isn't so bad, because the eggs would just break. There was no danger from egg throwing. But unless they boiled the eggs first, which they sometimes did, why would you go to a concert with eggs unless you already knew you were going to throw them, right?
Yes, good point. Boiled eggs.
So someone that does that, they're the ones with the agenda, not the artists.
So let me jump ahead. Your music now has been used in so many movies, and you've given so many performances, and it's even been used in TV commercials. So your music, which was so alien and even frightening to some people in the beginning, has become assimilated into America's musical vocabulary, into the world's musical vocabulary. And a lot of people copy it and have popularized it in their own idioms. Do you think about how your music has changed how people hear music or what they find acceptable and comprehensible?
the people have changed more than I've changed. But in the same way, we were talking about painters before. Someone like Jackson Pollock, when people would, you find his pictures in museums all over the place if people were lucky enough to have bought one. I think the answer to the question, of course, is in the question itself, and we both know the answer. What happens is that would seem strange and bizarre after a very short period of time starts becoming familiar, and whatever artistic rewards or secrets it might have become revealed. And now it depends. There was a certain amount of popularity that I have received, but in other circles I never did receive it. And there was a time when I was not even allowed to play in music schools. And if I played in a music school, I was usually invited by the dance department or some other department. And if I happened to be in the music building practicing, for example, I would see could see a notice on the board assuring the students that there was no need at all to come to hear me play that night. That went on for years. That has stopped simply because the young people who learned to like me are now the professors teaching in the schools, so that we don't have that problem anymore.
I want to play an excerpt of one of your early pieces. And this
Please.
Is Music in Contrary Motion. This is from 1969, and it's a solo piece. You're playing electric organ. So let's hear some of that. So that's Philip Glass, recorded in 1969, his piece, Music in Contrary Motion. And is that really solo? It's just unimaginable to me that so much can be going on with just one person. It sounds like you have three hands.
No, what's interesting about this so-called minimalist music is that it's how rich it is. The description doesn't come close to telling you what you hear. That was all these, if you listen to it, you'll hear, it'll seem like there are rhythms in the music that are being played or being stuck in the music, but they aren't really. It's just the result of the way the sounds work together when you play them very quickly together.
And there's something going on in the bass line in the left hand that is very in opposition mm-hmm. to the kind of speedy contrapuntal or whatever it would be mm-hmm. called lines that you're playing, and that low bass line, those slower notes sound like slow breaths beneath, like supporting everything mm-hmm. that's happening on top of it.
Well, that's of course my little finger of my left hand is what you're hearing, and
with sustain and that, from the organ, like from an organ pedal.
I probably hold on to that note a shade longer than the other ones because I want the effect of that bass line. So there are ways of playing that can bring out certain parts of it. The mechanical part of the part of it is actually not what's happening. What's really happening is that I'm not playing with a click track. I'm playing to my inner sense of rhythm. I'm making things longer and shorter and faster and slower. All through, if you were to put a metronome on the performance, you would find it would be changing throughout the piece. It doesn't appear that way, but that's in fact what's happening. There's a lot of room for interpretation and for change and difference, even in a piece as strictly repetitive as that one is.
And your left hand and right hand are kind of playing mirror images of each other?
Yeah, that's the contrary motion part, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The foundation of some of your music is the arpeggio, and some of these arpeggios are pretty crazy, and maybe they're not technically arpeggios, but they sound like that. And I wonder why arpeggios are so imprinted in you.
Well, you'll find that in Bach, and for the same reason.
Yeah.
Okay. The elements, we talk the elements of music being harmony, melody, harmony, and rhythm. Those are the three elements that we talk about. In the arpeggio, you have all three. You can, if you listen to the Bach unaccompanied violin pieces, it's just one line of music. You hear melody, you hear harmony, and you hear rhythm all in one,
right.
in the form of the arpeggio. So it becomes a shorthand, a way of getting the most out of the smallest amount of music. So I guess that's true minimalism right there.
For people who don't know what an arpeggio is, would you just like sing an arpeggio or hum an arpeggio?
Well, I can't.
Really. No. Okay.
It'd be da 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 da. Do mi sol do si mi da 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 da. Do mi sol. I do with do mi sol do sol mi do. That would be the solfege, and it would be. And if you listen to the left hand of a lot of the music of the Baroque, that's what you'll hear.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it in the right hand too. It comes up a lot in Central European art music because for those reasons, because you could articulate the elements of music in a very compact form and build on that. You could build all kinds of things on top of it, which is what which people like to do.
Because you couldn't make a living, a good enough living, with your music for several years, you did things like you had a moving van and had a moving business, furniture moving business. You had a plumbing business for a while. You drove taxis for about 5 years. Did you ever worry about your fingers when you were doing moving
furniture? Yes, I did.
I ended up,
I got out of the, I also was an assistant for my friend Richard Serra for a long time. I got worried about that, especially when I was doing in those days, in the plumbing business, another word plumb comes from the word lead, you know, it's the Latin word. And we used to, a lot of the work was done with lead, and it was hot lead, it was melted, and you could, I was worried about my hands. And eventually, the safest place for me to be was either moving furniture, which was actually pretty safe, and actually pretty good for you, too. A lot of up and down stairs, carrying books, not a very interesting thing to do. In a way, the driving was the easiest one to do, but it was the most scary too, because the city can be violent, and any taxi driver will tell you that it could be scary.
Yeah, you said every night you'd have an adrenaline rush when someone would get in your cab, and you'd wonder if this was going to be your last night alive. Yeah, so
yeah, that could happen. Yeah,
tell us one of those stories, though.
Well, these days we have partitions between the drivers,
right?
You know, but in those days it wasn't there. But I remember I was taking a young woman up to the Upper East Side in the maybe 115th Street somewhere in the East Side. And I was worried about taking her there. And I said, are you sure you know where you're going? She said, don't worry. It's just take me to this address. And there are a lot of tricks that you learn in the driving business. For example, when you come to an address, if there's a car in front, you don't go behind that car because another car can get behind you and you're trapped. So you don't do that. But you also keep the doors locked. And I had my doors locked. And I got to, and I said, are you sure you know where you're going? And she said she was. And we stopped at that address. And she got out, and four guys leaped at the car, and each one of the doors. My front doors were locked. Back doors were open. I floored it. I mean, within seconds, I was a block away. 2 minutes later, I was on my way downtown, and I picked up another fare and kept going.
Gee.
I probably could have been dead that night. That's the kinds of things that could happen. I got out of that as soon as I could, but it wasn't. I was in my 40s when I did my last day job. No, Terry, this is the story of being an artist in America. Whether you could be a poet, you could be a dancer, you could be an actor. In those days, the garages were full of people who were writers, and that's what it was.
Well, here's something I don't understand. Like, so you nearly get killed on a fairly regular basis driving a taxi, but you keep doing it in part because you don't want to teach. Yet the teachers you've had in your life have been so important to you, and I'm talking about music teachers, meditation teachers, yoga teachers, literature teachers, made a deep and lasting impression on who you are as a person and as a musician and composer, and yet you never wanted to do teaching yourself. Why not?
My mother was a teacher. I knew her friends. In those days, the people who came out of the what we call the Depression of the 30s, people who were trained to be engineers and different kinds of technical workers, we didn't have computers then, of course. They got jobs teaching because there was no other work around. It was a very unhappy crowd of people that were teaching in the schools in those days because they couldn't get the jobs that they wanted to get, so they ended up teaching. And my impression of teachers was that they were a pretty sad lot, and I didn't want to have very much to do with that. Now, the other thing was I didn't think I would have been a gifted teacher. The people I talked about were extremely gifted, and they knew how to teach, and they knew how to inspire, and they could implant technical tracks inside of you. They knew the system of teaching, they knew the system of practice, and it was successful. I didn't think I had that talent. I was afraid that I would be one of those teachers who wasn't a very good teacher, and the students wouldn't get very much from a person like me. So I decided I wouldn't do that. First of all, I didn't want to be in that company, and second of all, I didn't think I'd be good at it. And then there was another aspect to it, too. I really wanted to develop the independence, and I had that. I wasn't part of the academic world, and I never was.
Philip Glass, thank you so much for talking to us today. Thank you for your music.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Composer Philip Glass spoke with Terry last Monday. Glass has a new memoir called Words Without Music. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.